The Capital Ideas podcast now has a new monthly edition hosted by Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin. Investment professionals reveal their best mentors, how they find their next great idea, and a few funny stories. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. American Funds Distributors, Inc.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Americans are voting early in huge numbers, and what to look for when Trump and Biden debate for the final time on Thursday. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal, sitting in today for Paul Jagot. We are joined today by my colleagues Kim Strassel. Hi, Kim.
Hi, Kyle.
And Bill McGurn. Hello, Bill.
Hi, Kyle.
13 days until Election Day, and around 40 million ballots have already been cast. That's roughly a third of the total turnout from 2016, according to data from the U.S. Elections Project. And in some important states like Georgia, North Carolina, it's nearing 50% of the 2016 turnout. State by state, there's a lot of news stories you can find. Early voting began Monday in Florida and shattered records. Colorado's Secretary of State said last week that turnout to that point so far was 24 times what it had been 4 years ago. So many states relaxed absentee rules amid the pandemic, and people are obviously taking advantage of the increased flexibility. But Kim, it also seems, at least to me, to signal very high enthusiasm to get those ballots to the polls.
Yes. One thing I would just point out, I was doing my own math, so we'll have to look into this a little bit more closely. But according to my figures, in 2016, there were 136 million ballots cast. So if you had, what did we say it was, 30 million so far, that would be more like about 22%. So, but it's still really high up there. It's a lot of people are getting their votes out. We don't know how much of this is being driven by COVID, the fact that folks, especially those that are doing mail-in ballots, simply are concerned about having to go out in public into the polls. And so these are people who would normally vote, and they're simply voting early. We don't know how much of it is related to enthusiasm, which is a different question. And if so, enthusiasm on what side? I think you can put this down as yet one more oddity in one of the, what's going to count as one of the weirdest elections ever.
Yeah, the numbers obviously depend on what source you look at, and they're a moving target. The ones that I'm looking at is the U.S. Elections Project, which is run by a University of Florida professor. And another thing that's interesting about some of the data presented here is that some states report turnout, early voting turnout, absentee turnout by party registration. And so far, Democrats are pretty far in the lead. So in Florida, again, according to the U.S. Election Project, 3.7 million people have voted so far, 47% of them Democrats and 33% Republicans. In Pennsylvania, there's been about 1 million votes in, 73% of the Democratic. In North Carolina, about 2.2 million voters, 44% Democratic to 28% Republican. And so, I mean, Bill, is that that clear enthusiasm among Democrats specifically to vote early, vote absentee, something that you think the Trump campaign ought to be concerned about?
Well, I think it's one factor. But again, we don't know what the motivation is. I mean, you and I live in the same town in New Jersey. We presumably you got your ballot. I got mine about 2 weeks ago. I filled it out and dropped it the same day, mostly wanting to avoid what I thought might be a lot of chaos near the end of the pre-election day time period. I was worried that, you know, places will be closed. In our state, we have to vote by mail, right? We can't go vote in person. If you do go vote in person on election day, they'll take some preliminary vote and then presumably check it against the master list. But it sounds like a lot of confusion. So we'll see whether this reflects what it might, which is more enthusiasm for the candidates, or whether it's just that people are like me, we have to vote a different way and we're just getting it done early and out of the way.
And one, I mean, so far unanswered question getting to this weird year is what the breakdown is going to be on election day. I mean, there's been a lot of chatter. I think we've talked about this, about polling suggesting that Trump voters are much more likely to vote on election day. And that seems to be, at least so far, to still be holding. Last week, there was an NPR PBS poll that said 69% of people who say they're supporting Biden plan to vote absentee or plan to vote early, while 65% of Trump supporters say they intend to vote in person on election day. And so, I mean, obviously the question won't be answered until we get to election day, Kim, but this could have a lot to do with what looks like the strange early voting numbers.
Yeah, I was looking at some interesting numbers that were in an NBC news story, and I think that goes to your point. They were breaking out how many people have voted early so far in different states, and they also broke out who had done it in person and who had done it absentee, and then they also broke out that party affiliation that you were talking about. And interesting contrast, so the top two with the most total votes of people who have already voted are Texas and California. But they're kind of almost reverse examples. In Texas, the vast majority of people have voted early and in person, and it turns out Republicans are much outpacing Democrats in terms of the party affiliation attached to the ballot. Whereas in California, the vast majority of people have voted absentee rather than in person. And in that state, the vast majority of the Democrats are way outpacing Republicans in terms of party affiliation. So that might make your point. I would just a couple of other things, though, that I would throw out there about a little bit more cautious about reading too much into party affiliation. So, for instance, you were talking about the North Carolina numbers, 44% Democrat, 28% Republican. That leaves about 26% that are what you call unaffiliated. And, you know, these are often independents. A lot of people specifically choose to be independent because of how things work in their primaries, for instance. And you have no idea what direction those voters are going. Are they evenly split? Do they come down on one side more than the other? And you're seeing that in a lot of different states. And so I think that that's all worth bearing in mind as well, too, because party affiliation, you're going to see a lot of stories about this, but it isn't necessarily determinative.
But on that point, I mean, another thing that I'm wondering when I'm looking through some of these numbers is specifically on those independents. So in North Carolina, 600,000 people without party affiliation have cast ballots already. In Florida, it's 700,000. I mean, true, a fair point. Some of those people may be unaffiliated because of wanting to flip primaries, which primaries they vote in. But some of them are presumably these vaunted swing voters. And if a lot of them have put in ballots, Bill, already, does that mean that 2020 compared to 2016 may be less fluid, that some of these voters are already locked in, and that maybe Trump has less time than he would otherwise to turn things around if you believe the polls showing him behind?
Yeah, that's a legitimate argument. I'd say a few things. One is this year is different in a way because of COVID, because of these new ways of voting, you know, primarily by mail. And in an election where the margins are so thin in these battleground states, you know, any aberration can change the electoral votes of a state. So that's concerning. I have to say, in all this, I'm much more concerned about the votes that are going to be coming in after Election Day than before Election Day. Kyle, you've written on the problems on this, you know, quite often. And that really concerns me. For example, in Pennsylvania, the way I understand what the state has done, they will count votes that come in up to 6 days after the election, even without a postmark. I mean, that is just a prescription for people to start working on stashes of ballots if they end up needing them. So that's where my worry is. I think this is a mess. I think that an absentee ballot should be you know, a departure from the norm. I think there's something to voting on election day, to showing your commitment to being a citizen by voting on election day. And of course, as we see now, there's big news breaking at the very end, and the people who've already cast their vote, you know, might have thought differently if they had waited till the end. So I think we're kind of inviting a big mess, unless, Kyle, as you pointed out, unless it's a blowaway election. But I think that's going to be hard to do, given how tight the races are in certain states. And I think the worst scenarios are going to be if someone's declared a winner on election night in the state, and then other ballots come in, and then he becomes a loser.
I would just add one more cautionary note on reading too much into a party affiliation in terms of ballots returned. And that is just that party affiliation just doesn't always mean what everybody assumes it means, which means partisanship. So, I mean, and it varies state by state. Like in California, you can assume that if a lot of Democrats are ballots are being returned, it's because those are true Democrats out there and they're voting for the Democratic candidate. But look at a state like Pennsylvania, okay? In the 2016 election, Democrats had more than a million voter edge over Republicans, meaning that there were that many more Democrats registered in the state than Republicans. And yet Trump won it. And that is because, especially in a lot of those counties in western Pennsylvania, people are still registered as Democrats, but they don't vote Democrat. And that's not going to be a case, again, in all states. But if you look at a place like Michigan, look at a place like Wisconsin, any state that has more of a kind of white working class in particular, party affiliation gets watered down some in terms of what these ballots that are getting returned actually mean.
Hang tight. We'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from The Wall Street Journal.
The Capital Ideas podcast now has a new monthly edition hosted by Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin. Investment professionals reveal their best mentors, how they find their next great idea, and a few funny stories. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. American Funds Distributors, Inc.
From the opinion pages of The Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. On the question of changing minds, a good opportunity for both sides to do it perhaps is Thursday, when Joe Biden and Donald Trump will meet for 90 minutes in Nashville for the final presidential debate of 2020. Bill, what do you expect from this clash?
I don't know what to expect. I think that Donald Trump will be aggressive in trying to bring up the Hunter Biden story. His challenge is to be aggressive without looking rude and obnoxious and interrupting. And we'll see how well he does. I mean, a lot will depend. To me, the question is the bias that we see. It's not just that Joe Biden isn't asked a question, but when he is, like on the court packing, it's just perfunctory. They ask him a question, he won't answer it, then they just move on. Nothing to see here, folks. When it's Donald Trump making a statement, for example, statements on the peaceful transition, I mean, he was asked every other day 100 times, or like white supremacy, he just asked it repeatedly over and over. And it was only because Vice President Pence really forced the issue in a way that journalists should have, that it's really on the table. So one of the questions will be to see if it's more of the same, if the moderator just lets Trump bring it up or tries to interrupt him when he brings it up. We'll find out. We'll have to see. It'd be interesting. I mean, the FBI, I'm told, has made a statement saying they have nothing to add to Ratcliffe's assertion that there's no evidence of Russian disinformation. But I think the real question is people want to know, are they true? Is it really Hunter Biden's laptop? And are these things true? And if they are they damning? And it'll be interesting to see. Joe Biden should have to answer those specific questions instead of just being allowed to get away saying this is a smear, you know, from the Russians, and having all the press, you know, cower and cover for him.
Well, I'm not sure I like the odds of the moderator bringing up that story, but it seems almost guaranteed to me that President Trump is going to bring up that story. And this is about the emails published by the New York Post that were found allegedly on a laptop that had been owned by Hunter Biden and left at this computer repair shop and then given to Rudy Giuliani, who gave them to the Post. And Kim, I mean, it still seems a little murky, but do we know much more yet about this story?
Well, we're actually learning more every day, because what's happening is that the New York Post and now other outlets are beginning. I mean, well, mostly Fox News. This has been, as Bill pointed out, largely ignored and put in media blackout by the rest of the press, despite the fact that it is an absolutely legitimate story. So, you know, we had already known a great deal about Hunter Biden's time serving on a Ukrainian energy company's board, Burisma, and some of these emails touch on that, specifically the question of whether or not one of Biden's fellow Burisma associates actually managed to wangle a meeting with the vice president. Should point out that the campaign has pointed out that that was never on Biden's official schedule, but that doesn't really mean anything. That we are also getting some interesting new information about a potential deal that Hunter was working on in 2017. And this is notable because it was a period of time in which Joe Biden was not in office, but he was nonetheless debating a presidential run. And these emails suggest that he may have been in line to have he himself, Joe Biden, to have profited from a deal. We don't know if it came across, if it worked or it happened. But, you know, the campaign, two things that are noticeable to me, they keep denying or kind of semi-denying certain things, saying, well, you know, look at Joe Biden's tax returns. You don't see a Chinese deal on there. But more importantly, no one in the campaign has denied the authenticity of these emails. And that to me is striking. And to Bill's point, I mean, I think that the Trump campaign's attitude at this point is that they can't rely on the moderator of this debate to bring up any of this. And so I would be prepared for Donald Trump to use a lot of the debate to ask these questions himself and put them to Joe Biden, and not just on Hunter Biden. You know, were you in talks with your son and the Chinese about a deal in 2017? You know, but other things, especially the foreign policy issues that are not really going to get a hearing at this debate, unfortunately. You know, hey, Joe Biden, would you have moved the embassy to Jerusalem? You know, what do you think of my Abraham Accords? And see if, I mean, he's probably not going to get an answer, but at least remind the audience of what a pass Joe Biden's getting.
Well, let's split these here. There's two issues you bring up. The first one is on the, just to finish up on this email story. One of the important things that happened in the last week or so was that Fox News now says that it has confirmed that at least one of these emails is genuine, according to one of the recipients of the message. And it doesn't mean that everything is genuine. I think reporters and investigators and Congress is still trying to work out all the details of this story. But it's a little hard to clear it up, Bill, without Joe Biden or Hunter Biden explaining what's going on here. But it seems to me that the fact that reporters have now confirmed that at least one of these emails is true really raises the pressure on the Biden campaign to substantively address it.
Yeah. And I think, frankly, the FBI as well, they've had this computer for 10 months. You know, it was leaked out there that they're investigating the computer as a possible Russian disinformation campaign. It's, no one has said they're investigating it as maybe it's a money laundering scheme or something that Hunter shouldn't be doing, and whether they're true. And it's just very interesting to me. Fox was able to confirm one of the emails. How much anyone else has confirmed, or if they even tried? Because it seems to me, if they're true, the first question is, are they damning if they're true? And the second question is then, are they true or not? And so far, there's not a lot of evidence. There's no evidence is Russian disinformation, according to our intelligence agencies. And there's not a lot of evidence that it's not true. Even as Kim points out, even the Biden campaign is not denying it. It's very interesting, because you would think if it's not true, you would come out and say, this is absolutely not true. I don't know who produced this computer, but it's all false. And they're not saying that. And the reason that they're not saying it and getting away with it is because they're let off the hook. You know, again, if this were Donald Trump, not only would Donald Trump be pestered about it, every Republican leader, Mitch McConnell, Lindsey Graham, they'd be badgered about it as well. But this is not what's happening right now.
And then on the issue of the debate topics, so the moderator, Kristen Welker of NBC, has reportedly chosen six topics for the debate, which are fighting COVID-19, American families, race in America, climate change, national security, and leadership. And with a 90-minute debate, that breaks down to about 15 minutes for each of those topics. And I mean, maybe national security, that's maybe that involves some foreign policy issues. But Kim, I mean, as you suggest, 15 minutes to talk about foreign policy from, you know, the normalization of relations in the Middle East to the diplomacy with Kim Jong-un to, I mean, there's a lot to grab onto there.
Oh, absolutely. And the Trump campaign is understandably quite miffed about this because they had been operating on the assumption, as in traditional, is traditional when we have presidential debates, that one of these debates was going to be solely devoted to foreign policy and that this was indeed going to be the one. And instead, as seems to be happening nonstop with the Commission on Presidential Debates, we're getting last minute changes. Apparently, they were even trying to negotiate yet some more last minute changes just in the past few days. So the Trump campaign's unhappy about this, but it's a disservice to the American people, too. It is a dangerous world out there, and we have had a lot of things happen. And yes, the Trump campaign is eager to talk about some of their breakthroughs out there, in particular, you know, those peace deals that they have signed between Gulf Arab nations and Israel. Obviously talk about questions like the U.S. embassy in Tel Aviv and the Iranian nuclear deal, which was a horrible thing negotiated by the Obama-Biden administration, and talk about what Joe Biden would do and why it make him defend that. But, you know, look, the Biden campaign ought to also want to be able to talk about this because there's some interesting, weird aspects of the president's foreign policy legacy as well. North Korea, for instance, and, you know, those strange negotiations. Where do we really stand on Russia? You know, is it good to beat up on NATO all the time? Or on the other hand, has it actually gotten them to contribute more to what, you know, our international efforts? So a lot to talk about there. And instead, I have no idea what 15 minutes on American families is going to be about, but I have a pretty good belief that it's probably not going to be something that is going to be very useful to the country, at least not as useful as foreign policy.
Finally, there, while we're talking about wrangling over the debate rules, there's been a lot of focus on the mute button. The commission says that each of these six topics will begin with 2-minute opening statements by the candidates. And during that statement, the opposing candidate's microphone will be put on mute by the production crew of the debate. And the idea here is to allow that 2 minutes to pass without any interruptions, and then both microphones will be on for the rest of that section of the debate. And the intent, they say, is that both candidates agreed to 2-minute opening statements, and the mute is just to enforce that. The Trump campaign is taking issue with this, saying it's a last-minute change and an attempt by the commission to provide advantage to Joe Biden. Bill, how do you weigh that argument? I mean, is that a reasonable change or not?
Well, I have two reactions. On the micro level, I don't really have an objection to this. It's 2 minutes. Let someone have their statement. As you mentioned, that in the rest of the time period for that question, the mics will be on so they can go at each other. And if they interrupt, they'll be judged harshly for it. I think it's, again, go back to the previous question you have. The problem we have with the debate commission, the way they impose this rule, it's so imperious as though they're more important than the candidates themselves and the elevated status given the moderators. I have more of an issue with the moderators. I would rather the campaigns or the candidates ask each other the questions that they want to ask. And I think in a good debate, you could have different rules, but the main thing would be that each candidate gets to pose questions to the other about the issues he or she thinks important, and the other gets to do the same. In this, the idea that a single moderator chooses all the questions, I think is very anti-democratic and imperious. I think there's a role maybe for moderators in that. If the two guys go out at the end, they have a chance for one or two questions that they think weren't, that both candidates ignored or one candidate ignored, they could ask it. But I think we've got it rearranged. You know, the paper is on record as saying we should abolish the commission and let the terms of the debates be settled by the campaigns themselves. And I think that's an excellent reform.
Thank you, Kim and Bill. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back later this week with another edition of Potomac Watch.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.